based in England with the 8th Air Force. I was a pilot in the 457th Bomb Group, and I had been shot down and lived with the French underground, and I was captured by the Gestapo through the intervention of a Belgian girl who betrayed me to them. And the incentive for her to betray me was for 20,000 francs, which at that time the exchange was worth $400.
Do you remember the approximate date of your capture?
Yes, approximately the 1st of August, 1944.
44. Prior to this time, had you witnessed any examples of German cruelty or atrocities against soldiers or civilians?
I don't know how to classify them, if they are atrocities as such, but you could feel and see the strain of, in this case, the French people living in what was their country being occupied by an enemy, and not such a sympathetic enemy. And I don't guess enemies are never sympathetic, but
yeah, well, I suppose that living as you were in the underground, you really weren't exposed to German Gestapo until the time of your capture, so probably you would not have been in really a position to see what was going on, or do you think possibly you were?
I would say the things that I could see, because where I first was hiding out or being hidden out by the French resistance was out in a town called Jouy, a town that was a hamlet, Jouy-la-Châtel, which is approximately 45 kilometers southeast of Paris, farm country essentially. And when the French, or the, well, beg your pardon, when the German troops would come through to go to the Western Front, they would commandeer anything they wanted from a farmhouse, be it horses, carts, oxen, food, wine, the normal things, I guess, that advancing armies do in occupied countries.
At the time of your capture, had you heard any rumors or reports of the mass murder of Jews and political prisoners in Germany?
Never heard anything like that, except we knew that, and I was told by the French people that I mingled with, that they knew there were camps where some of their people were taken, mainly Frenchmen, were taken to work camps, but they were referred to as work camps.
Then you had not heard of the existence of concentration camps up to the time of your capture. Do you recall, Mr. Allen, where you were first taken after your capture?
Where I was taken after I was captured?
Yes, the
I was immediately taken to Gestapo headquarters in Paris. And I was interrogated there and spent the night there. And then the next day, I was transferred to Friends Penitentiary in Paris.
To your knowledge, the people, the French underground who shielded you during that period, do you know if they suffered as a result of aiding your, keeping you from capture?
I know that the Belgian girl was taken by the French resistance and killed, because when after the signing at Reims, I got in contact with my main protector, who was a French institutrice, a school teacher at Jouy, and they had in their clandestine way, followed my passage after I left. I might mention this. The French people that I was with did not want me to leave because they said, we never know who will betray you, because the way the underground worked was that if you and I were in the same underground and we were, let's say, passing an Allied airman from one to the other, I didn't really know where you came from, and you didn't really know where I was going, and you can understand the reason for that. But if one of us was captured, they could torture us to death, literally, but there wasn't much we could say of factual information. So the chain would be broken if one was captured. Now, why was I saying this? Well, that was why they didn't want me to leave.
I see.
Because even though I transfer you to one in the so-called same underground, we really cannot trust one another. And the other way that was brought home to us is before we would leave on a mission, our intelligence would give us different advice depending on what country or countries we were apt to be shot down over. For instance, if we were going directly into France and back with no diversionary route up through Belgium or wherever, we would be advised to take a sidearm, and if we were shot down and not captured, that we should not be prepared to try to shoot our way to freedom, but rather wait for a single individual to be searching for us or calling for us, and in fact be prepared to hand over the sidearm to the individual, because the odds were that he was working for the resistance, which was working for the Allied effort. On the other hand, if we were going to a country like we might be shot down over Poland or Germany, we were advised to take a sidearm, be prepared to shoot your way to freedom, because the odds are that some of the civilians would have had damage and killing done by American bombers, and they would not feel very friendly toward you and would be ready to pitchfork you at a moment's notice. After spending approximately 6 weeks at Jouy, six men came for me, each all with bicycles and one for me, intending to get me into Paris, where they would, where I could be lost, so to speak, in the crowd, and be safer than in a little village. We got into Paris through what they used as a ruse. I was given a French passport. My name was Louis Rouet. At that point, Cherbourg had been bombed, and I was categorized as a refugee from Cherbourg, was a mason by trade, and was deaf and dumb. When we eventually got on a train to get into Paris, my status to the French guards who came through and examined everybody's papers were that I was a Frenchman and I was their prisoner. And I had all French clothes. I had no military identification, because if they did search me, you would have obviously put the French people at risk. Trying to pawn me off as a French citizen. They also gave me a heavy burlap bag to carry. And the bag was never investigated, but I will tell you that there was dried meat and some small arms in the bottom of the underneath the meat, so that if they had investigated, they would have seen dried meat. Well, I lived with these six men, by the way, were the French secret police, and I lived with them in a flat up on the fifth floor, down near Vincennes, near the zoo, and they engaged in what I saw was some small sabotage. For instance, they killed a Frenchman who was what we called a collaborator, and the way you can get the book on a Frenchman if he's a collaborator is whether or not he's driving a car, because the restraints on petrol and movement of the French people of being restrained for those reasons allowed just, believe it or not, veterinarians had a priority for petrol for driving their cars and the German personnel. And of course, if you were a collaborator, you know, that's the only way you could have been driving your car. And of course, once they saw you driving your car too often, then they would follow you and see what your behavior was. Well, from there, I was taken to the hospital because I was, they took me to a German-occupied hospital because my back was killing me with pain, and I had received, believe it or not, six different doctors came and gave me a shot of morphine 6 days in a row, and I was upset about this. After I said, "Hey, I can't continue to take this morphine," and I said, "Turn me over to the Germans." So, believe it or not, they carried me down these five flights because they didn't have electricity to run elevators. They just dumped me in a hospital in Paris, where I was given a catheter procedure because the estimate of the doctor apparently was that I had either a blood clot or had loosened some salts in the urinary tract, and that was blocking my the urinary tract, and this was their way of relieving that. It was in the hospital that I got discovered, because after I was in there, 7 days all told, and after about the fifth day, a girl with a ledger came in speaking French to me, like, she was like, "Who are you in this room?" And I, of course, at this time, I can't speak anything because I'm not supposed to, I'm supposed to be mute. But on the seventh day, two men came for me with an extra bicycle, and we went to an apartment where I was to be rigged up, and was rigged up to make the overland trip to the Pyrenees. And I was given French clothes, hobnail shoes, French money, French cigarettes. And of course, as I said before, I was not allowed to keep dog tags or any military identification. But in the process, as I mentioned before, one of the links in this chain of underground people was this Belgian girl. And we were, at this point, when I was introduced to her, we were now going to leave Paris. And we got on the metro, which is the subway in Europe, and we came out of the exited the subway, and I can still see the building with the Academy, the music on it, so it was in that area. And we went around the corner and up a little side street to a typical French curbside cafe. And she waltzed me up to a table where two men, and she just disappeared. And this one obviously German civilian, pulled out his pistol and stuck it in my neck and said, "I'm sorry, you're our prisoner," and ushered me into a car. And we made our way to Gestapo headquarters. At Gestapo headquarters, I was interviewed or interrogated, and of course, again, I'm maintaining I'm military personnel, and you've got what you might call a typical movie scene where there was pounding on the table, and the words were, Alles Militär, Nick Saboteur, Nick Spy, Ah, Militär. And I was just dumb enough to say, "Yes, that's right, Militär." And I said, kind of goofy as I look back, but I said, "And I want to make a formal request for a military interrogation." Well, the kind of luck that was with me was it was getting near the end of the war, and they probably didn't feel too secure, and maybe their minds were on other things, but they sent me down the basement where there was a common cell for many prisoners, and there I met some other GIs in uniform. And in about, we stayed at that, we were taken out of Gestapo headquarters the next day, and we were all taken to Friends Prison in Paris, which is a walled penitentiary. We were there approximately a week when I was called down. I was ushered down by a guard, and I really thought I was going to be executed because they were executing people in the yard every day. But as luck would have it, I was ushered into a cell that was made up into an office, and there sat a Luftwaffe officer, and he treated me very respectfully, very casually, devil may care attitude, and had ushered me to a chair, threw a pack of Camels at me. I said, "I'm sorry, I don't smoke." He said, "Oh, take them, give them to your friends, do what you will with them." Okay, so I took them, and they became a good piece of trading bait for food later, but however, we were there not too long after that, and the entire prison was evacuated, and that was really a mess because 99 9/10% of the prisoners were civilians, a lot of whom were women, not predominantly, but there were eventually wound up to be two 40 and 8 freight cars full of women. So we got on what was the last train, the last convoy of prisoners that got out of Paris. And we were 5 days on that train, part of which our car was naked. And that's another scene that is humorous, because it's a little tragic. 92 men in 1 40 and 8, all naked, with nothing but cans of sardines and the equivalent of a large pretzel can as a toilet. And we were naked because we managed to get six prisoners out of our car, escaped. Whatever has become of them, I don't know. But we did get six out, a patch in the floor of the car. The car, as you may not realize, made a lot of stops because it was not given priority on the main tracks, and we were sidelined, you know, sidetracked, they should say, many times, which would give somebody a chance to get out of a train while it was stopped, or just before it would start up is really when the escapes were made. The fifth night we wind up in Weimar, and somebody says, it was a Frenchman on the car who spoke a variety of languages, including English, and he said, "Oh my, I think we're going to Buchenwald." And none of us had ever, "What's Buchenwald?" Well, we soon found out once we got in there. And we were immediately stripped of our clothes, everything. We were, you've heard about the rooms, the big, large communal shower rooms where you could either get showered with water or showered with gas, and we were in one of those. And we were showered with water, and then ushered into another room where we all stood on little stools and had every hair on our body clipped off except our eyelashes and eyebrows. And the purpose of this was twofold. It was advertised by the Germans as pest control, bug or lice control, which probably it was, did have some effect that way, but it also was terribly demoralizing. And if you ever want to laugh at yourself, look at yourself someday with all the hair taken off you, and if you happen to have any in the first place, you look like a chicken hanging in a kosher delicatessen. We were then issued. Shall I go on?
Oh yeah.
Okay. We were then issued two garments. I got a T-shirt and a pair of denim pants. No shoes. This transport of prisoners was given two blankets for three men. We did not have shelter for 21 days. And the system was that each night a different fellow of the three would have the inside between the other two bodies. Running out of tape? And on the 21st night, it was raining very hard and it was cold, and we were ushered into a what they call a block, and in that block were over 700 Hungarian Magyar gypsy boys between the ages of 8 and 12. And as you may have seen pictures of the, I'll call it the warehousing of prisoners, the shelves of men, like four or five high shelves of men. These kids were draped all over there, like over those shelves like monkeys. They were ushered out to make room for us, and they were all killed. And they did have a crematorium at Buchenwald. They did have a scaffold where, I forget, 10, 12 people could be, I will say, choked, not hung, because there was no trap doors. You were just, you had a noose put around your neck, and you were just drawn up to suffocate. And the way I know this, the way I saw this, is that at Buchenwald there was a rocket factory, V1, V2, I forget, the rockets that were coming across the channel. You remember?
V2s. The buzz bombs. That was the buzz bomb.
Well, part of that operation was being done at Buchenwald, believe it or not. And as I may have said previously, and I'll repeat it, Buchenwald was both a work camp and a killer camp. So I got access to the second floor of the factory and could look over into the courtyard, so to speak, of the crematorium. And as you may have heard, or don't find it difficult to believe, there were dead, partially dead people put down the chute into the crematorium. As far as what we ate at Buchenwald, we were up at 5 o'clock, 5:30. We got a small gemmel of ersatz soup, which was like broth. By that I mean it had very little or no solids in it. And that was all you got, and that, I would say that cup was like the size of a giant sized mug. Then we got fed once again at 5:30 at night, where we got another gemmel, which was the shape and size of an ordinary soup dish. And we got a ladle of what was almost always barley soup. And of course, I must tell you, there was very little barley in it. Now that was, oh, and we also got a ration of black bread. And I would say the ration was approximately an inch to an inch and a quarter thick. So needless to say, everybody lost weight, and as the pictures that you've seen of survivors or those who didn't survive, they were nothing more than skin and bones. There was an awful lot of dysentery in the camp because it was in the water. We were told never to drink the water. You want to take a break there?
No. Mr. Allen, when you were interned at Buchenwald, you were there as a military prisoner of war?
No, I was there as a spy and a saboteur, because I had no military identification at all. I was in French clothes. I had French papers when I was taken to Gestapo headquarters. However, there were military people there. For instance, a plane shot down in the vicinity of Weimar or Buchenwald, where there would be parachutists, they would be and captured. American Allied soldiers and officers captured, for want of a better place to put them, they'd throw them at Buchenwald because they didn't have any Stalag, maybe, you know, there was no Stalag near there. So they would be thrown in there for the want of a better place to put them. So you saw, there were a total of 80-some American military people in Buchenwald, but very few of which had uniforms or were caught in uniform. Some had been caught the same way I had, through the underground. and that's the way most of them were.
So while you were at Buchenwald, you actually lived with and were treated as the other inmates, a concentration camp.
Like everybody else.
Not military.
No, like everybody else. The only, there were also 2,000 Danish policemen interned at Buchenwald, which carries a little different so-called treatment. Namely, they were allowed to write letters and get letters from home. They were allowed to get parcels, food parcels from home. And the Danish policemen, at times, when they were able to, would share some of their food, which was biscuits and cheese and pâtés. But through that, I must mention that 2 years ago, September, they had their 40th observance of their liberation from the camp, and the Danish people, the Danish government, got in touch with some Canadian prisoners, ex-prisoners of Buchenwald, to invite them to come to Copenhagen and participate in the observance. And there were two Americans who went. The Canadians got through some system of communications through the various the ex POW, so all the various military associations got in touch with me and Bill Powell. And the two of us and our wives, along with the Canadians, participated in Copenhagen with the French government. French government, come on, Danish government. And I want to mention this, that the Canadian Air Force took us all over there free. That is the airfare, the transportation. Some of the representatives of the Danish police met us at the airport. We were we participated in a state dinner with the I guess she's the queen over there. It was a principal speaker, and all in all, they treated us very, very nice, and they even offered, in a tactful way, to pay anyone's way for any expenses they would incur if any of us didn't have the means to come over with our own finances. And because they said they had a fund for such a situation. They made it clear to us that we didn't realize at the time, 40 years ago, that we were great morale builders for them. They felt a lot more comforted, I guess, that we were there, and they noticed maybe, I don't know, our attitude. And they found us to be beneficial in that respect. Now, I got to open
While at Buchenwald, would you say that the treatment that you received at the hands of the prison guards was any different from the treatment shown the inmates of concentration camp? No respect as an officer of the...
No respect.
You had no status as a prisoner of war or as an officer of the United States Air Force. No status whatsoever.
No status at all.
Were you aware at the time of... the ratio of inmates, you mentioned Hungarian gypsies and others. do you have any idea at all of the ratio, say, of political prisoners, nationalities, Jews, as inmates?
I have no official way to document this, but the word was that the predominance of predominant percentage of people were political prisoners. At that point in the war, I think the French had the highest population. There was a Jewish cell in the corner of the camp, and as far as I know, they were not treated any differently, and the ones that I happened to witness being killed were, at my time being there, were Russian soldiers. They brought in a transport of Russian soldiers, and I was told that they can kill them, and because they did not come under the rules of the Geneva Conference as far as the agreed upon treatment of military prisoners. So they were hung up and killed. Now, I must mention that I did get out of Buchenwald before it was liberated, and what happened after I left, I can't attest to, of course, but the rumor is, and I have to call it a rumor, is that there was some extensive killing, and there was going to be more, but there were, evidently there was fear that reciprocity would be taken because the Allies were coming too close to overtaking the camp.
While there, were you able to make any contact at all with prisoners of war who were at Buchenwald at
that
time?
You're calling them prisoners of war. Now, they're not prisoners of war as defined, but you mean other prisoners.
Prisoners.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, no. I actually, were there, let me ask you this then. There were some who were there at Buchenwald who were there with military status as prisoners of war.
Right.
Yeah. Were you able to make any contact with with them?
Yeah, we were together, like the mm-hmm. Americans were all mm-hmm. in the...
Oh, there were Americans there.
Yes, the Jews had their places, mm-hmm. all the Poles were in their areas, and the French were in their blocks. They were, to my knowledge, there was not a lot of intermingling of nationalities in the one mm-hmm. block.
Were you forced into labor, as were the inmates of the...
There was a bombing. I was not forced to work, no. And neither were any of the other people around me, be they the Americans, Canadians. But there was a fire. There was a bombing raid on the V-2 factory by the Americans. It was a daylight raid. And I must say it was a very good raid insofar as the pinpoint bombing. And like all, after most every kind of a bombing raid, there's fire, and they came, some of the German guards came to our block because, you know, they said, you come and help put out the fire, you know, you have training, and they thought we were trained people. So some of our fellows went, I didn't go. And I, you know, I said, I'm not going to put out their fire, and furthermore, I don't have shoes. So none of our people got hurt doing that, but that was the only extent that I can think of any kind of work. Now, I had mentioned earlier to you, Phil, that there was ersatz money in the camp, and I never had any. And the reason I didn't, see, I never went on a work detail, and I wasn't assigned to any kind of work. So on the one hand, while I ate and slept and was clothed and was exposed to the whims of the lager schutz like everybody else, I was not imposed upon to do any labor. I might mention, I just used the term lager schutz, which for that means camp police. One of the many things that made concentration camps so inhumane, so bizarre, was the multiplicity of types of people. For instance, I said that the main body, and of course you must realize that we're talking about a given point in time. You know, things could have been different at a different point in time. But at this point, the main body of inmates at Buchenwald were political prisoners. But if you think about Hitler's ambitions with regard to the establishment of a true Aryan race, one of the aspects of achieving this was to get rid of all the possible people that could have offsprings that were not subject to producing a true Aryan. Now, for instance, at Buchenwald, the lager should, so in this effort, Hitler emptied all of his asylums. the Lagerschutz was made up mainly of what had been criminally insane German prisoners. So they were Germans, but they were criminally insane prior, and still were prior, but that's what was there. They had been in institutions prior to going into Buchenwald. So the environment was that hits you in the mouth or hits you with a stick, a club, and then tell you what they wanted. So that made the environment pretty hostile. Also, there were any person with an infirmity. You know, if you had a club foot, if you had one leg, if you had an incurable disease, if you were just old and senile, this was all part of the prison, the body of prisoners, and they were doomed for execution or just dying, and dying was just such a normal course of events that every day there were several of us would go walk along the street, so it's not the street, but the road inside the camp, and look and see if we recognize anybody in the pile. We saw people killed. I saw the people killed with needles. They would be injected in the back, and they would very well know they were going to be dead by morning. And after the capo, they called him, who was a guy who walked around with boots and a white jacket and a red cross on his arm, would insert the needle and leave, then every one of his nationality would collect around him and I guess get some last wishes or whatever. But I saw young kids, older men. I saw some of this because I got sick, and I was put in a block, a sick block, or a block for sick people who could not stand the appel, meaning we had an appel every morning, and for those of you who, that's a gathering on the parade grounds of all the inmates to be counted. We had one every morning and every night. And one night we had one that went on for 3 hours. This evening appel, they were dictating or orating warnings in five different languages, which took, 3 hours. Discouraging any of us trying to escape. So at this time, I didn't have shoes or stockings, and it was cold, and there was snow. So I got pneumonia. I was diagnosed by a French doctor who was a prisoner. All he was allowed to do was come in and pat you on the head, but he told me I had pneumonia and pleurisy, and I eventually developed dropsy, and which meant I couldn't stand up or walk. And dropsy, for those who are uninitiated, is most often caused, I understand, by malnutrition. And it was manifested by the swelling around the ankles and the general weakness. So I had a time to stay in the sick bay. And I saw they had a big bathtub. It looked like a water trough for horses. That was that large. And they would, people who, let's say, would, if you'll excuse the expression, would be better off dead, were dunked in this water. this cold water and wrapped in a rubber blanket, and two able-bodied looking, I presume Polish prisoners would come in with a litter that consisted of two pipes and chicken wire, and they would just proceed to lift up these puny bodies and put three on the litter at a time and take them out and throw them on a pile. Most often they would do this water dunking at night, and then of course the next morning, usually the inmate was dead, or almost dead.
Were there gas chambers in operation at Buchenwald at that time?
At no time did I know of a gas chamber being operated at Buchenwald at that point in time.
Most of the bodies were disposed of in the ovens, the crematorium.
Yeah.
While at Buchenwald, having no status as an officer in the United States Air Force and no status as a prisoner of war, I would imagine that you were then denied the privilege of communicating with your family, mail, packages, anything of that nature.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right. My wife didn't know I was alive until 6-7 months after I went down.
Can you recall approximately the date that you were taken from Buchenwald and where you were taken from there?
Well, let me take a minute. Well, to my knowledge, I was the last American to get out of Buchenwald, and the reason I didn't go with the others who had already gone was because I was sick and couldn't walk. And I was taken approximately a week before Christmas. I was taken to Stalag Luft 3 at Sagan. And it was there that we were allowed, three different compounds, the American compound, the British compound, the Canadian compound. And because Christmas was coming up, they were allowing calling from one compound to another. And my bombardier, Joe Bruce, had already been a prisoner since the day we were shot down. And he, by that time, being in a Stalag, had been communicating with home, and he called over to just find out if there was a guy named Roy Allen over in this compound, the other compound, and because he happened to be with the British or the Canadians. And that's when I learned that my wife had had a boy and everything was fine at home. Then.
At that point, had your status changed at all from a spy and saboteur?
Yes. My status by then had changed from a spy and saboteur to military personnel by virtue of the Luftwaffe officer who interrogated me at Friends Prison. Now, I must tell you how our conversation went. The requirements for military personnel when they're captured are to give nothing more than name, rank, and serial number. Now, these are the rules established by the Geneva Conference. The routine of an intelligence officer is first to be disarming. You know, I had mentioned that he had tossed the cigarettes to me, and then he wanted to know why our president had gotten us into the war, and why do we take a stand against Germany? And this is, again, is to throw you off the track, so to speak, rather than to be hostile, because they want to get information. Well, it so happened that when I gave him my name, rank, and serial number, he knew when I was shot down, and he also knew that I had been flying deputy lead that day. And he said, and he knew what post, he knew my outfit. I guess you see they capture the, they get the numbers off the airplanes that fall or that are shot down, and then somebody in England can tell them where those numbers, you know, what field they come from and who the post commander is of that field, that air base, I should say. So he said to me, oh yeah, your commanding officer was Colonel Looper, and he does very well on his raid. When he leads a raid, he's been very successful. And I must say that. But he said, well, of course, we'll get him. Well, the fact of the matter is, he, unbeknownst to me, he had been shot down sometime after me. But, he terminated the interview or interrogation, and I'm a little bit concerned because I know what I haven't said to him. And I said, sir, may I ask you a question? And he said, sure. I said, will you tell me whether you are going to regard me as military personnel or spy and saboteur? And he looked me right in the eye and he said, where is the escape hatch for the pilot of a B-17? And I told him. And he said, I cannot do anything for you until these papers clear Berlin. So it was, they got clearance, I guess, from Berlin, and then they sent someone for me, a German sergeant came for me at Buchenwald and took me to Stalag-Luftbrücke.
As a prisoner then, at the Stalag, would you say that your treatment at the hands of the prison personnel were very different from your treatment while at Buchenwald?
Yeah. Oh, sure.
And then you were treated as an officer of the Air Force.
Yeah. Except for food. Except I will tell you this. I personally got what they call at Stalag 3, when they, you know, the commanding officers took one look at me, and they immediately had me get a physical and put me on what was termed invalid rations. And
pardon me, not to interrupt, but would you say that your condition then was due to the fact that you had been in Buchenwald as a concentration camp inmate?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, no question about it. The 21 days and nights of exposure, the rain and cold and some snow, and the lack of nourishment, and the disease that pervaded the place. There was no things like toilet tissue, and you weren't allowed to drink the water, and that had dysentery in it, and I guess the general demoralization, and you know, and you see, when you see other people being killed, you see other people dying, you see inhumanity, man's inhumanity to man, it doesn't help your morale, and you need your morale to keep your health.
Would you say that your treatment and the treatment of other prisoners you saw there at Stalag III, would you say that the Germans were adhering reasonably well to the terms and agreements of the Geneva Convention?
You're talking about the Stalags now.
Stalags, yeah.
Well, there, I guess yes and no. As far as any physical abuse, there was no physical abuse. Camaraderie with the German prison guards, there was a touch of that. I would say there was the only, I call it mistreatment, was we were not getting the Red Cross parcels that we were supposed to be getting. And again, this is just a rumor, I couldn't prove it or disprove it, but we were told when we eventually marched down to Moosburg, which happened to be the distribution point for Red Cross parcels, that the warehouse was loaded with them, but they were evidently keeping them, you know, the suspicion was, or the rumor was, that the Germans were keeping the Red Cross parcels for themselves.
To your knowledge, Roy, were there any Jewish prisoners of war in the Stalag III?
Yes.
Were they treated, as far as you know, were they treated any differently than the other prisoners?
Not in the Stalag. They were not treated any differently. At Stalag III at that point in time.
Yeah. while a prisoner there...
Excuse me. Remember, I'm talking in the context of the war winding down with the Germans taking the worst of it. So, how they were behaving prior to that?
By this time, we're speaking of probably early spring of 1945, I guess, where we are, we not?
Yeah, I was on the march when Roosevelt died.
That was April.
I was on the march from, that was April, yes, on the march to Moosburg.
The Germany surrendered May the 9th, I believe, 1945, and I believe the death of Roosevelt was early April, so this was probably then just about 1 month before the end of the war.
Right.
While a prisoner, of course, you were eyewitness to atrocities at Buchenwald, but then while a prisoner of war in Stalag III, were you aware, did you hear anything about additional Nazi atrocities against humanity, other concentration camps?
Yes, by this time, I'm the only fellow, you know, in my, let's say, the people I was quartered with who knew about Buchenwald, and you know, there was no end to questions they would ask me. And then, of course, word got by that there were places like Dachau and Auschwitz, and we knew that for instance, Jewish members of an air crew would have two sets of dog tags. They would have their Christian dog tags and their Jewish dog tags. And then there were also some Jewish guys that said, hey, I'm a Jew and that's what I'm going to wear. So, but we were not aware. If your question is, were we really aware of what Dachau and Auschwitz was? No, not really.
Can you recall the approximate date and by whom you were liberated, Americans, British?